Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. I started Zen practice when it was still very new to this country, 50 years ago. I was in my early 30s when I discovered the practice and was really drawn to it. And in those days, the early 60s, you know, the whole idea of Zen was in the U.S. was pretty foreign. It was a very foreign idea. It had connotations of being metaphysical and cultish and very academic, because everything that you could read was all written by scholars and professors. But I was drawn to Zen practice, you know, despite its still being a bit odd in the culture. And I didn't want to keep it a secret. So I told some friends and some close acquaintances at work, and we shared some ideas. And I told my parents. And they, of course, didn't understand what I meant. What are you doing? What? You can imagine. You can imagine the expectations they had of their college-educated son, who was supposed to be going to be middle class and successful. And I said, I'm going into Zen practice. It was just a total shock to them. They didn't understand. They didn't know what I was doing, and they didn't know why, and they were baffled, and they asked me to explain. I couldn't explain. I couldn't explain Buddhism. Well, first of all, I was too new to it to really understand it. I only had a feeling about Zen practice, which doesn't rely a lot on books and words. It's a practice which was real. It was active and alive. So anyway, my parents were, their heads were spinning. My father went out and got a book, much to his credit. I don't know what book he got, but he went out and bought a book, and he made some attempt to understand what I was doing or what I was attracted to. And when we met to talk about it, he said he was very disappointed. He said, Buddhism is negative. He read the book, or part of it. Buddhism is negative. What are you doing? He couldn't understand why I was interested, and I didn't understand either from that standpoint. So our discussions in this first year or so didn't help much. But I have to say that after some years, he started to understand a little something, and he came to accept it. Why did he have the feeling that Buddhism was negative? Well, you know, the teachings of Buddhism are very rational. Very rational. Buddhism is a result of some very insightful people taking a very close look at reality. What's going on? Real life. What's happening? And what Buddhism proclaims is nothing is permanent. Nothing is real. Everything's an illusion. If you read that, when you first start to read a book about Buddhism and you read that, that seems kind of negative. Nothing exists. What? Nothing is real. Nothing is permanent. And that's confusing. And Buddhism does not paint some rosy picture of what a nice place you'll be in the future someday. Buddhism is rational because it is based on evidence. Evidence of our own experience. The teachings all come from our own experience, which is a form of evidence. And it doesn't speculate. It says, here's what you experience. And when you do experience it, you know. You know without having had it explained to you or reading about it in a book, you just know something. You know. But this knowing is counter to what's called common sense. And we all rely on common sense. So without some experience of the practice, without a little bit of knowing, it seems very confusing. Because it's counter to what we see and believe. It's counter to common sense. So Buddhism is, to me, I think it's very much like medical science. It's like exploring an illness. And in the case of our lives, the illness is, what Buddhism proclaims is, life is full of suffering. This is our illness, it says. Life is full of suffering. And if we, you know, stop for a minute and look around at the world and at life, it seems obvious that there is just, the world is just full of suffering. So this is kind of obvious truth, you know. But you know, a lot of people don't like to hear that. So it may seem like Buddhism is negative, even though it says, here's the truth of things. If you don't want to hear that message about suffering, you say, oh, this philosophy is negative. So if you look at the literature of Buddhism over the centuries, it describes, it always comes back to the an illness that exists in human life, this suffering that is always present. We can't get rid of it. And Buddhism says there's suffering, and then it goes on to describe the symptoms. It's all very negative. It feels very negative. So when you first start reading about Buddhism, you don't get any kind of uplifting feeling, you know, like you would hope you get this. It's negative, and here are the symptoms. So Buddhism says that the symptoms or the causes of your illness include ignorance and delusion, foolishness and indifference, as well as desire, clinging. And we just chanted about that a few minutes ago. And then Buddhism says, well, the medicine to treat these symptoms include following the Eightfold Path, leading an ethical life, and engaging in the meditation practice. This is the medicine that Buddhism prescribes for the illness of suffering. So these teachings and this philosophy, if you will, by itself is not a solution to the problem of suffering. The solution, you know, the relief of suffering, the solution lies in our personal practice. Not what's in the book, but our own personal practice is the solution to suffering. So Buddhism may seem negative to some people because it goes against common sense. Buddhism says that everything is one, there is no separation, but our common sense tells us that, sure, everything is separate. What are you talking about? That's common sense. Buddhism says, no, you have to see it another way. And that's very confusing. Until you start to practice. If you keep the teachings separate as an idea, or as a philosophy, it doesn't make any sense. So there is a poem, short poem. It says, the blue mountain is not disturbed by the white cloud. The white cloud is not hindered by the blue mountain. So you have an image of the mountain and the clouds floating by, and you're watching it, and you watch the clouds come across the mountain. And you see that the mountain is not disturbed by the white cloud which moves across it. And the white cloud is not stopped or hindered by the blue mountain. It just goes on its journey. And this short poem is a vision of the harmonious relationship between the relative world that we live in and the absolute. A harmony between a transient existence of all things and that which is beyond permanence or transiency. Everything that exists or has existed, is both at the same time, absolute and relative. The white cloud could not exist without the blue mountain. And the blue mountain is not the blue mountain without the white cloud. In other words, the transient nature of the cloud enables us to understand and appreciate the mountain. And the mountain can exist for us because of the impermanent cloud that floats by. And when we see the relationship that way, this is known as non-duality, non-separation. Blue mountain exists because of the cloud. Cloud exists because of the mountain. Now, we human beings live in the world of duality. The last line we chanted in our service tonight was to be free from the duality of birth and death. Duality, birth and death, fast and slow, like or dislike, right and wrong, successful or not successful. Duality is a world of opposites. And they, in the world of duality, the opposites cannot include each other. They exclude each other. Like and dislike, you can't do both at the same time. Right and wrong, you can't do both at the same time. This is the world of duality. The world of non-duality is when the mountain can exist because of the cloud. But we live in the world of duality. We do not live in monasteries. We do not live as hermits in the forests or the caves. We live in this everyday world of duality. And with the busy lives that we have, we don't have much time to have a peaceful mind or to have a calm mind because of the world we live in. We usually do not have any time to forget or to set aside our dualistic life and our dualistic way of seeing. So we come to this practice so that we can quiet the dualistic chatter of our mind and get some glimpse of our non-dual nature. So recently somebody asked a question. Can we be enlightened if we don't suffer? Can we be enlightened if we don't suffer? We can't answer that kind of question in a rational way or in the way of common sense. So what we say is, what has been said in response to this kind of question is, you just have to practice in the midst of delusion. So we live in the world of duality, but we practice non-duality. We live in the world of attachments and judgments, but we practice the way of non-attachment. When we pay careful attention, so when we pay careful attention to our life, that we live dualistically, our everyday life, where we have to live dualistically because of the activities we are responsible for. When we pay careful attention to how our dualistic life is going, we recognize some difficulty. We recognize some problem, some confusion, some suffering when we pay attention. And this recognition leads us to start the practice of non-duality here in the Zendo. And this is why we say that our delusion is enlightenment itself, and our suffering is enlightenment itself. Just like the white cloud and the blue mountain, one cannot exist without the other. In the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I think most of you have read, there is a chapter about weeds, how weeds grow, you know, even we don't like them. But we pull out the weeds and we put them next to the plant, so that the weeds, as they decompose, can nourish the plant. In the same way, we use our difficulties that come up in our life. We use these difficulties to help nourish our practice, to help us. So our attitude towards our difficulties or our suffering is very vital. If we complain too much, wishing they would go away, well, it doesn't help. It solidifies the suffering. But if we experience our difficulties when they arise, look at them carefully and don't judge them. If we embrace them, they help us. So, we should be grateful for the weeds that grow in our garden because they nourish the plant, and we should be grateful for our difficulties and allow them to nourish our understanding. We should be grateful for the all those things that we at first think are negative, because eventually they will enrich our practice. So we should experience mind weeds and see how they provide nourishment. And this is important, to understand how our weeds provide nourishment. And when we pay attention to that, the nourishment that comes from our difficulties, we begin to understand our own capacity to purify ourselves and how to act properly, how to act in ways that support one another and in ways where we can learn from one another and how to be truly friendly with each other. In other words, we begin to understand that we have Buddha's capacities. And because we have problems in our life, we eventually come to understand our inherent qualities that we have overlooked. And we begin to understand the relationship between enlightenment and desire and the various forms of suffering. The relationship is inseparable. Through our practice, through our dedicated practice, where we set aside words, where we set aside our dualistic world for a time, we begin to see the meaning of why we are, the meaning of why we have been given this life, and how we should take care of it. And we see that our life is, should be lived beyond ideas of suffering or comfort. When we see our life in terms of suffering or comfort, we are seeing the world dualistically. So through our practice, we see our life is really beyond those concepts. So our practice begins by our acknowledging our difficulties, acknowledging our suffering. And that is the beginning of the end of suffering. But without this practice, it's possible that life takes on a negative feeling. If we try to understand it just with our common sense and our intellect. That's why the practice is so vital for us. Would anybody like to share their own story of how they started practice and what it was like for them? Anybody have a story? Yes, please. Yes.
I can definitely relate to your story about your parents when you first started practicing. I had similar conversations with my parents who were highly suspicious of this thing that I was doing. And I was also at pains to really articulate to them, or even to myself, at the beginning, like what it was that was driving me to do the practice. For a long time, I think I found it hard to articulate exactly why, or to be able to explain to anybody else. And my father, I think, was probably of the two, the person who tried most to understand what I was doing. But you know, years later, I think that we still think it's a phase. Still hoping I'll grow out of it. I'm disappointed with that. And I see it as my own shortcoming in some ways that I've not been able to express to them what I see as the necessity of this practice for me. But I keep trying.
Thank you. Yes, Lee.
Yes. Your lecture is very apropos of a conversation I was having with someone just before we came into meditation. For me, I think growing up, my delusion was that life is supposed to go smoothly all the time. And when tragedy struck in my life, it's like so many of us, I thought, why me? Why is this happening? I could not really understand it. And when I found a book on Buddhism that was aptly titled, When Things Fall Apart, because my life had fallen apart and I felt shattered. But some of the things that were said in that book were that this is what happens to everyone. There's no firm ground for us. The nature of our human life is that there's no firm ground. So we have to learn how to be flexible with whatever happens and not feel that we are singled out in the universe for misfortune or for something going badly for us. So for me, I had lost many of my family members and my parents certainly by that time. So I didn't have to explain it to anybody. So that was a good thing. But to me, oddly enough, the idea that we don't live on firm ground was reassuring because I understood that I had been living in delusion all of this time and thinking that, you go to college, you get a degree, you get a job, and everything goes, everything will be rosy if you do everything right. Life will just go so smoothly, but it doesn't. And for all of us, there are bumps in the road of varying sizes. So just seeing the idea that we don't live on firm ground as human beings made a lot of sense to me. I realized that I had been looking at everything. I had been looking at life in the wrong way. So for me, when I started sitting this practice with other people, I felt that there was an energy of support coming from all of us striving in our own way to find our practice. And now it's about, it's probably more than 10 years later. And I really feel that this practice has proven to be so valuable to me, and just given me a sense of joy and peace and readiness. So that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, are there any questions about starting practice? Yes, please.
Does it get any easier as far as when I was sitting for those 40 minutes? There was a lot of chatter, inner chatter.
So, David is nodding his head. Maybe he can give you a good answer.
Christian upbringing, and so when I came here for the first time, I saw the Buddha statue, and I was thinking of, you know, thou shalt not have any graven images before me, just in, deep in my subconscious mind. And so I was envisioning, you know, like hell, and, you know, I was in a very dark place. But over, I've been practicing for 4 years now. Now when I sit, I reach a place inside of me where there's insight, and there's, I can trust myself, and I can, you know, just like my life has kind of gone from being out of balance to balance, living an ethical life. So, so because of that, sitting is very more comfortable.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, we shouldn't make promises, but there are stories. Thank you. Yes, please.
I recently had an experience that touched me deeply. That was like a random day experience, and I went to this place and I ran into someone I knew and not very well, and on this really deep level was able to help her with this strange set of occurrences that could be described as synchronicity or fortuitousness or luck. And I liked what you were saying about duality and non-duality, because it was kind of like without, she and I actually prayed together without putting forth, you know, wanting things to happen as whatever way they happened. We believed it was the right way, and trusting in our higher power's will instead of our will. And it all ended just kind of beautifully, and I liked how you were saying the, it couldn't have unfolded the way it did, at least my explaining of it, without believing in the higher power, without surrendering kind of our will, and it just, it all happened like that. But then I'm wondering if I'm just trying to apply too much common sense to it and trying to analyze it too much instead of just accepting it as it is and making it into this magical story of how everything just came together perfectly. And that then I wonder if that's a delusion of mine, trying to apply this real rational explanation of how it happened instead of just accepting it as how it happened. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Your question about it, about what your mind may be doing with the experience, you know, do a little bit of, you're expressing a little bit of skepticism, saying maybe I'm just making this too logical. And that's good. That's good that you don't just get carried away. But from what you said, it was clear that you had some deep feelings about what happened. And that's the main thing. You know, you experienced something beyond the words and the mind and the explanations. Yeah. Something between you and your friend. Mm. So you can trust that feeling part. And at the same time, it's good to keep a skeptical eye on that part of the mind that wants to do a rational explanation of it, and to not let that take over, but go with the feeling and trust your own feeling and your sense of that there is something greater that you trust in. Have you seen your friend since that time?
Not in person, but okay. We did communicate via text.
Oh, good. Okay, that's good. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.